The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about programming robots to lie. Why would researchers program robots to lie, Dave?
Well, Rob, it's a great question, and one they don't really answer so well in the study, although they do say, you know, humans lie a lot. We often lie for good reasons. For example, you might not want to tell somebody they're having a bad hair day. There are analogous situations for robots, especially in military uses, where it would be useful for a robot to behave deceptively or at least differently than an enemy might suspect.
So how in this study were the robots deceptive?
Well, Rob, there was a very simple setup in the study, and sort of think of it as a game of hide and seek. A robot sits there, and you can actually see a picture of this robot on the site, and you can actually see a video of what's happening here on the site as well. But these robots are these sort of little gray things, and they've got cameras mounted on them, and they've got four wheels. They look like almost like little dune buggies. And you've got a robot sitting there in front of three different colored markers. One's green, one's red, and one's blue. And the markers are all on paths to different hiding places. And these hiding places are essentially little cubby holes that the robots can hide behind. And what happens in a normal game of hide and seek when these robots aren't programmed to behave deceptively, if the robot goes along the blue path, then it's going to knock over that blue marker on its way to the hiding place. And this is what they call the hiding robot. And then if the researchers put a seeking robot or a finding robot in afterwards, and they say, okay, finding robot, you've got to figure out where the other robot hid. The finding robot is programmed to go, okay, I'm going to look for which markers knocked down, in this case, the blue marker. I know the other robot went along the blue path. I'll go to the blue hiding place, and voila, I found the robot.
And what happens when the robots are programmed to deceive?
So when the hider robot is programmed to deceive, what it does is it'll knock down a marker, but it won't necessarily follow the path that that marker is on. So for example, as you can see in the video, the robot, say, knocks down the red marker, but instead of continuing along that path, it backs up, all of a sudden goes down the blue path, for example, and hides in the blue hiding place. And what that does is when the seeker robot comes along, it goes, oh, well, that robot knocked down the blue marker, must be hiding in the blue hiding place, goes, checks there, and surprise, the hider robot's not there because the hider robot has deceived this finder robot.
So is there a way to program the seeker then to be aware that the hiding robot might be deceptive?
Well, that's an important question, Robin. One of the reasons the deceit works so well in the study is because that second robot is programmed to trust what it sees. And the authors say, you know, if this seeker robot was just a bit smarter, programmed to be a bit smarter, the deception wouldn't work nearly as well. So you've got bit of a gamed situation here because one of the robots is very trusting, the other robot's very deceitful. But if the robots are programmed to be a little less trusting, probably more a little bit like humans were, then the game of hide and seek might turn out a lot differently.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of things hiding, this next story is about tiny chemical modifications to DNA that have been hidden for many years, but researchers are finally starting to find them and figure out what they do.
What are these chemical modifications called?
They are called methyl groups, and basically what they do is they bind to DNA, and they act as sort of a volume control knob, and they can turn the activity of a gene up or down. They can even turn it on or off.
The science of epigenetics, then.
Exactly. This is called epigenetics. And what's really interesting about it is, you know, we've thought for a long time that when it comes to thinking about our genetics, it has 100% to do with our genes. If we have a specific gene mutation, it might lead to diabetes or other genes control height or eye color or whatever. But what's interesting about these epigenetic changes is that it's another level of regulation in the body. So it's saying that it's not just your genes that are important, it's how these genes are modified. And researchers have been studying these for a few years, and they're not exactly sure how they work and what particular conditions these epigenetic changes might be associated with.
So what did researchers study the epigenetics of in this study?
Well, researchers were looking at the epigenetics of obesity, and specifically they looked at 74 Icelanders who had been in a study for about 4 decades studying various things. And so there was a lot of data on these people. And the researchers looked at their DNA and they looked for these epigenetic changes. They analyzed over 4.5 million places along the genome of each of these people. And what they found was they found a handful of regions where a lot of people tended to have these same epigenetic modifications.
And these were changes that happened during their lifetime.
Well, that does happen. In fact, some epigenetic changes you inherit from your parents, just like you inherit your genes from your parents. And some epigenetic changes develop over your lifetime. But in this study, what the researchers found, they found 13 of these, what they're calling methylation sites, so these sites where there are epigenetic similarities between a lot of the people they looked at. And they found that at these 13 sites, there was a strong link between the methylation pattern and whether or not a person was obese. Some people with more methylation in a particular region were more predisposed to obesity, whereas others with less methylation in another region were predisposed. The pattern varied from site to site. But what the researchers saw overall was, beyond just the genes, they were finding this connection between these epigenetic patterns and obesity.
So all of these people might have the same gene, but it was a function of whether or not they were turned on or off, or how high the volume was turned up, as it were.
That's exactly right.
Any way to modify the volume then, or turn it off or on?
Well, it's a little too soon to say that, Rob. What the researchers do say is, well, first of all, they say that just because you have these modifications doesn't mean you're necessarily going to become obese. It's just like with genes. You can have mutations that predispose you for certain things, but that doesn't mean those things are actually going to happen. A lot of it has to do with other factors such as environment. What the researchers do say is that we're trying to enter this era of personalized genetics or genomics, where a doctor could look at your gene profile and figure out exactly what conditions you're going to develop and hopefully try to treat you proactively. And we've got DNA, we've got genes already in there, but now we can throw in these epigenetic changes, and it just gives doctors and researchers another tool, another way to monitor people to figure out the best way to personalize their health.
A better way to say whether someone's at risk for becoming obese or not.
Exactly.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from protecting people from obesity to protecting mountains from erosion. This last story is about how glaciers can sometimes act like geological blankets for mountains.
What's an example?
So the example researchers looked at in this study was in the Patagonian Andes, and this is a mountain range that's on the west coast of South America. And some of these mountains have been heavily eroded by glaciers. And you may remember that glaciers are supposed to be this really destructive force in nature. They're almost like nature's buzzsaws. They can grind down mountains. They can even carve valleys. So they're a very destructive force. And that's what researchers saw in some of this mountain range. They saw these mountains that should have been a lot bigger, but were pretty smooth and ground down as glaciers passed over them about 5 to 7 million years ago. But there were other mountains in this range, in the more sort of southern part of the range, that were a lot higher and were a lot rougher. And it looked like they hadn't been touched by glaciers at all, even though researchers knew there had been glaciers in this area millions of years ago.
So what do they suppose happened?
Well, to find out what happened, they went to visit this mountain range and they collected a lot of rock samples, and they did something called thermochronology. And basically, what this involves is shooting a laser beam at grains of these rock samples that they collected. And this liberates certain isotopes in the rock. But the basic idea is this technique can tell researchers how young a rock is. And here's why that's important. If you were to pluck a rock off the surface and this technique told you that the rock was very young, chances are that meant it actually came from the interior of a much older mountain, but the older parts had been eroded by a glacier. Whereas if you were to pluck a rock off a mountain and this technique told you that rock was very old, then you could assume that that mountain hadn't been very well eroded because all of its old parts are still on the surface. And what the researchers found was that these mountains that seemed very well preserved, the rocks on the outsides were also very old.
Suggesting then that the glacier actually didn't come to the top of this mountain or just didn't erode it?
Well, basically that it didn't erode it, because they know the glaciers were here. And what they suspect happened is, based on some climate data that they have, is that the more northerly mountains that did get highly eroded, the temperature was warmer there. And this causes a thin layer of water to form under glaciers because you've got these warmer temperatures. And that helps the glaciers slide down the mountain. And as you can imagine, you've got this ginormous chunk of ice sliding down a mountain. It's going to cause a lot of damage, cause a lot of erosion. But in these more southern latitudes, the temperature was actually colder. And that meant the glacier was practically frozen in place. It couldn't slide down the mountain. And in fact, what happened is because you had these glaciers covering these mountains, they almost acted as a sort of geological blanket or styrofoam so that when other elements that typically erode mountains like wind and water came along, these mountains were protected by these glacial blankets. And therefore, they didn't erode nearly as much as the mountains farther north.
Any broader implications then?
Well, one of the researchers says this shows that there's a really strong link between climate and mountain building or mountain erosion, because here it was just a small difference in temperature caused these massive differences in what these mountains look like. Something that geologists have long debated.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how tracking your friends might help predict flu outbreaks and also new insights into the history of the moon. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about research into animal-human hybrids and just what the public thinks about that. And also, we're continuing our coverage on stem cells, what's going on in the U.S. since a federal judge effectively banned federal money for stem cell research. That ban was recently stayed, but there's a lot else going on. There's also a lot going on with the midterm elections in the U.S., which might influence future stem cell policy in the U.S. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.